therefore possible to gather up all of the great and noteworthy expressions of faith found within the Scriptures. And if it were possible then to gather up all of the great and noteworthy expressions of faith throughout the 2,000-year history of the Church of Jesus Christ, we would soon discover, dear friends, that all of these great and noteworthy expressions of faith were dependent upon the existence of certain necessary conditions. Conditions that need to be set in place prior to the expression of great and noteworthy manifestations of faith. And here are four of these conditions. First of all would be the recognition of helplessness and nothingness. Second, the absolute assurance of being in God's plan. Three, the possession of the promises of God. And four, a willingness to act on the basis of nothing but God's faithfulness to those very promises. These are conditions that are absolutely essential for faith to be expressed in any kind of great and noteworthy fashion. Now, friends, as we turn our attention this morning to the life of Moses, we have to acknowledge right from the very start that it is impossible to deny that he was a man of massive gifts, perhaps matched only by the Apostle Paul in the New Testament Scriptures, a man of massive abilities. I don't think there's any other way of saying it. But if you read the inspired word regarding Moses, we discover that he was a man of really omnicompetence. He was a man of incredible physical strength who, on the day of his death at 120 years old, possessed as much physical vigor as a man half his age. He was a man of keen intellect who was afforded the finest education of his day. Despite his frequent professions to the contrary, we discover from the book of Acts that Moses was a man who possessed great and powerful oratorical skills. We're also taught in the Word of God that he was a man appointed to lead a nation of people on a trek to the Promised Land. And as such, the Bible tells us that he possessed all of the natural leadership skills to accomplish that kind of endeavor. A man of massive abilities. And yet of all these God-granted gifts that would be pressed into use that he might fulfill God's destiny for his life, it is, dear friends, the quality and nature of his faith that the writer of Hebrews wants us to consider this morning, and as you will see, I think, compel us to emulate, to model, to go after, to display in our own experiences. Now, despite all of these massive abilities and these tremendous gifts, by the providential workings of God, all of the conditions necessary for a great display of faith were present in the life of Moses. There was first and foremost on his part a clear recognition of his own helplessness and nothingness. You discover very early in the book of Exodus that never has there been such a successful leader filled with more reluctance than Moses. Reluctance to such an extent at one particular point in time, God gets exceedingly angry with Moses for refusing to take up the charge that God had given to him. 40 years. 40 years on the backside of a desert taught him all sense of self-reliance was futile where the program of God is concerned. He was a man of helplessness and nothingness. And yet he was also a man, we come to see, filled with the assurance that comes from being ordained by God to fulfill the plan and purpose of God. In fact, as a confirmation of his call on the life of Moses, God gave to that man something he had never given to a person before. He gave to Moses his own covenant name. He says, "I want you to go and tell the people of Israel, I am, has sent you." He was a man who bore in his heart the very promises of God. "I have promised to bring you up out of your misery into Egypt, out of misery in Egypt, into a land flowing with milk and honey." And because he had been given that promise, he was a man then who would dare to take great action for God solely because he was absolutely convinced that God would be faithful to his promises. If you can imagine it, he actually had the audacity to stand before the Pharaoh and say without shame, "God says, let my people go." My friends, you cannot read the Old Testament Scriptures and fail to see the significance that has been assigned to this man, Moses. It is nearly impossible to overestimate the place he occupies in the redemptive plan of God. It is the book of Deuteronomy that closes with his epitaph. It reads like this: "Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all these miraculous signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and all his officials and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel." The inspired writer basically is saying this: there's never been another one like him. There's never been another quite like Moses, of his stature, possessing his influence. To the Jews, you must understand, even Jews of the first century when the New Testament was written, Moses was the greatest of all men. For one, he was Israel's greatest prophet. Unlike the other Old Testament prophets, God communicated with Moses intimately and directly. God himself says this about his relationship with Moses: "When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this is not true of my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face." Clearly, and not in riddles, he sees the form of the Lord. Moses experienced unparalleled intimacy with God, and as a result, you know that when he came off Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments under his arm, his face was luminous. He had been in such close proximity to the living God that, as it were, the outrang of God appeared on his face. He was Israel's greatest prophet. He was also Israel's greatest lawgiver. All of the Old Covenant law came through the pen of Moses: the Ten Commandments, the sacrificial system, the priesthood, the design for the tabernacle, and the Ark of the Covenant. Moreover, Moses was Israel's greatest historian. I would remind you that Moses authored everything from Genesis to Deuteronomy. Moses was also regarded as Israel's greatest saint. The Old Testament says that Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. The fact of the matter is, friends, most powerful leaders are not known to be humble men. And yet Moses is considered the most humble of all the human race. And finally, Moses was considered Israel's greatest deliverer. The book of Exodus records for us the deliverance of 2 million people out of what proved to be the most powerful nation on earth at that time. That Moses himself goes head to head with the most powerful man on earth at that time. And at the end of the day, I remind you that it is Moses who alone is left standing. By the hand of Moses, God performs miracles and signs and wonders. Moses repeatedly intercedes as a priest for the Hebrew nation when God himself wants to destroy them. For 40 years, all told, he led the children of Israel through the wilderness right to the edge of the promised land. My friends, in all of the record of the Word of God, this is perhaps arguably the greatest foreshadowing of the ultimate deliverance that would come about through the greater Moses, Jesus Christ, in his work of delivering people from the bondage of sin and eternal condemnation. The New Testament writers steadily go back to the Exodus as the greatest portrait of what it is God does for people. And of all that could be said about this man, Moses, it is his faith that the writer of Hebrews wants us to ponder, and even more than that, beloved, to emulate. He wants us to see that this is a faith worthy of our embracing, worthy of our modeling, and in particular for these Hebrew Christians, it's the kind of faith that can still you in the strength of temptation, the temptation to fall away from Jesus Christ when doing so would make your life a whole lot easier. It's the kind of faith that is worthy of our consideration when lessening our grip on Jesus Christ a little bit will relieve pressure and opposition and hostility and antagonism. The writer of Hebrews now draws upon the life of Moses and sets forth before us three features of his faith worthy of emulation. Feature number one: It is a faith focused on the blessing of heavenly reward. Feature number two, it is a faith preoccupied with the being of God. And feature three, it is a faith dependent upon God's sacrificial provision. Now, for this morning, we'll only consider feature number one and finish two and three next Lord's Day. It is a faith focused on the blessing of heavenly reward. It is a faith riveted upon and preoccupied with the ultimate reward that the faithful saint will receive in heaven. This is really the key to Moses' life, beloved. If you ever wonder what would make a man do the kinds of things Moses did, it is grounded in this particular feature of his faith right here. A faith focused on the blessing of heavenly reward. Now look at verse 24. By faith, that is acting on the basis of faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now you know the story, friends. Moses was an Egyptian prince. Moses was an adopted son into the royal family with all of the inherent rights that go along with being an inherited son, a naturally born son, I should say. He was an adopted son, but under Egyptian law, that gave him a full rights as son. Some scholars even suggest, even to this day, that Moses may have been the heir apparent to the Egyptian throne. And so you can imagine the kind of lifestyle that he had grown accustomed to the first 40 years of his life. You can imagine servants readily attending Moses as he's sitting under the awning of a royal vessel floating down the Nile River. But while there, his memory would undoubtedly take him back to the story he had been told time and again by his birth mother. The story of another vessel on the Nile. Story of a baby boy being placed into a basket that had been converted into a kind of makeshift boat, having been covered with tar and pitch so as to make it impervious to water. See, long before the days of Adolf Hitler, the Pharaoh of Egypt had introduced his version of the final solution to the Jewish problem. The systematic slaughter of all male babies. His intention was the women would be assimilated into the Egyptian culture. Our objective is simply to eradicate all of the men, all of the male babies thrown into the Nile River. And so you remember the plan of Amram and Jochebed and Moses' elder sister Miriam. After 1,000 kisses, no doubt, Moses is placed into that basket and he is sent down the Nile River at the exact moment, at the exact place where the princess of Egypt came to bathe. Well, by and by, she discovers the basket. She feels compassion for this baby. She takes him into her home. She adopts him as her very own. Miriam, who had been strategically positioned, she is the sister of Moses. She offers to find a nurse for the baby. And by, it is Jochebed, Moses' own mother, who is hired to be the baby's nurse. Now, to be sure, he would be raised in the Egyptian court. He would attend the Oxford of the ancient world. He would know the finest of life's luxuries. But beloved, what we must not forget is in those earliest and most formative years, right within the slave hut of his own parents, this man Moses was surrounded by the atmosphere of pure faith. It was there he was made aware of his origins. It was there he was taught of the one true God over against the polytheism of Egypt. It was there, to be sure, that he was made conscious of his call to be the deliverer of the people of God. And then at some later point, and we're not told when from the Bible, Moses is taken to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he is formally adopted as her son, with all that that status implies, all of the dignity and all of the grandeur that goes along with being a prince. And this week, you know, I've been wondering about this thing, thinking a bit about it. The nature of the struggles, the dichotomies that must have been going on in the mind of Moses, particularly as a young man, as an adolescence, growing into adulthood, wondering to himself, who am I really? Am I what my parents have said that I am? Or am I what I see all around me? Am I really a prince in Egypt, or am I a Hebrew destined to be the deliverer of the people I'm now a part of a system that is exploiting? Who am I? Well, beloved, we're told now that when he was grown up, the text says, when he had grown up, the book of Acts tells us at this point that Moses is 40 years old. In other words, this is not a decision that is made in youthful impetuosity. Here is Moses as a fully grown man. He makes his decision. As it were, in very strong language, he refuses to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Finally, a day in the life of this man Moses came, when at least, according to his own wisdom, it was wise to make such a decision known. You remember that scene? Moses comes across a savage Egyptian taskmaster who is violently beating a helpless Hebrew slave. And it angered Moses greatly. And if you know anything about the life of Moses, you know that his temper was something that he struggled with until the day that he died. It was the very thing that kept him out of the promised land. Well, Moses sees what's going on, and he knows there's no way to restrain this Egyptian taskmaster. The taskmaster is operating under the authority of Pharaoh himself. The fact is, the only way to stop him would be to kill him. And so the book of Exodus tells us that Moses looked to the right, and he looked to the left, and with no other Egyptians in view, he struck the taskmaster down dead. And just as quickly buries his body in the sand. Now, friends, the wisdom of Moses backfired on him, didn't it? He figured, you see, that word would quickly spread throughout the slave population. God's champion, God's deliverer, God's anointed one has finally come to us. He's come to take us out of this place. The problem, however, was that though Moses was God's man, this was not God's time. And so rather than being embraced gladly by the Hebrew people, his leadership is outrightly rejected by them. And as a result, what happens? Moses needs to run for his life. He needs to begin to understand what helplessness and nothingness is all about. This business of leading for God is not, I bring you my gifts, I bring you my abilities, I bring to you this plate with massive skills, you use it for your honor, Lord. No, that's not what this is. He needs to experience what authentic helplessness really is. And so he runs to Midian, where he spends the next 40 years learning that self-reliance has no place in the man of God. But the point being, the moment came when Moses made his decision. He drove his stake into the ground and he turned his back on the status associated with being the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And it's very interesting to note, beloved, that the word here translated refused, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, is the same term that is used elsewhere to mean to be an apostate, to fall away, to turn away, to apostatize. You see what the writer of Hebrews is saying? Moses turns his back on the privileges of being an Egyptian prince. In other words, he apostatizes from Egypt so that he might not apostatize from the call of God on his life. And you see, beloved, there is this gentle barb that the writer of Hebrews is prodding his readers with. You see, for them, their commitment to Jesus Christ is arousing hostility and persecution. It's mounting. It's becoming more intense. There they are, this little band of Hebrew Christians sitting in the light of Imperial Rome. The Romans hate them. Their own Jewish families have rejected them. And they're beginning to think to themselves, life would sure get a whole lot easier if we'd give up on this Jesus business. We could go back to full-orb Judaism and everything in our lives would be hunky-dory all over again. And the writer is saying to them, Moses apostatized from all of the comforts of Egyptian life so that he might not be an apostate of the living God. You, my Hebrew friends, you have turned away from the shadows of Judaism to embrace the substance of Christianity. You must not now apostatize from authentic religion, even if in so doing it makes your life easier. And what he does, you see, is he takes their greatest saint, he takes Moses, and he shows how as Moses refuses to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter, it initiates in his life not a life of ease, but to the contrary, a life more difficult than Moses could have ever imagined. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Here's really the essence, the substance, the nature of this refusal. He chose to be mistreated, violated, abused. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. Now, friends, you need to understand something here that is very, very important. We need to appreciate, we need to understand the nature of the decision that Moses is making here. When the writer here speaks of Moses as choosing to identify himself with the people of God rather than enjoying the pleasures of sin, he's not suggesting here that Moses is turning his back on a lifestyle of lewd, sinful, self-indulgent, immoral practices. No, that's not what he's saying. The fact is, verse 25 helps us to interpret verse 24. In other words, the refusal of Moses to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter and all that such an exalted status would mean, verse 24, is the same thing as forsaking the temporary pleasures of sin, verse 25, or according to verse 26, turning his back on the treasures of Egypt. All of these are speaking of the very same thing. Refusing to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter, refusing the treasures of Egypt, turning his back on the pleasures of sin. The issue, my dear friends, has everything to do with the unique call of God on the life of this man. What God had appointed for this man to do in God's program. This is not to suggest at this point, you see, that a royal life, a life of royalty, is inherently sinful. This is not to suggest that great wealth or abundance or affluence is a sure sign of a compromised spirituality. I would remind you, beloved, that prior to Moses, we read about whom? Joseph, exactly, who until his dying day enjoyed an exalted status among the Egyptian people. And nowhere at all in all of the Word of God is Joseph condemned for that. He experiences great power, great wealth, great honor, great esteem. For 80 years he lives the life of a royal official of the highest order. Now, the passing pleasures of sin have nothing to do with royal position inherently, nothing to do with affluence inherently. It's getting at something a bit different here below. You think a bit about this comparison and contrast between Moses and Joseph. How is this difference to be explained? It's to be explained quite simply like this. Each of these men had a unique role to play in the outworking of God's plan for his people. Under the authority of Joseph, God's people, the covenant people, are saved from starvation. They find refuge and survival in Egypt, where they grow into this vast multitude. The ministry of Joseph, you see, was a ministry of preservation. 400 years later, when Moses comes on the scene, the people of God are writhing in agonizing oppression. They are no longer a small extended family. They've become a nation, 2 million strong, anticipating life in the land that God had promised to them 4 centuries earlier. The role of Moses at this point, not to preserve, not to protect, but to deliver, to lead the people out. This is God's design for Moses, to then reject that unique purpose, for the life of enjoying royal affluence would be then something exceedingly sinful for Moses. An enjoyment that the writer says would be temporary at best, lasting only the duration of this life. A drop in the bucket when compared to the reality of eternal bliss in heaven, which becomes then now the driving compulsion in the life of Moses. It says nothing to do with the reality of royal life, nothing to do with the reality of affluence. It has everything to do with God's unique and distinct call in the life of this one man. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God. Reminded of the psalmist who says, better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. But beloved, we still need to press into this thing a bit further. We need to take a bit more penetrating look at this thing. Because you could imagine Moses being a man, like all of us as human beings, rationalizing to himself, I mean, after all, occupying a position of power like that is no small thing. I could serve God from this position. I could help my people. I could make life easier for them. I could relieve some of their suffering if I step into this position of power that is now rightfully mine as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Why would Moses consciously choose mistreatment? Why would he knowingly relinquish his position of privilege? Why would he set aside this earthly security and comfort he had known for so long to choose in its place incalculable dangers and mistreatment? Well, at the very least, brothers and sisters, there are two answers to this question. The first is implied and the other is explicit. The first is this. He prized identification with the people of God. He cherished, he regarded highly identification with the people of God. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God. And the way this is structured in the original is this mistreatment is a mistreatment that goes along with being connected to the people of God. He knew that when he was choosing to be with the people of God, it would arouse mistreatment. And yet he wanted to be with them, identified with them. There was a desire on the part of Moses to be attached to these people who belonged to God, who were the very possession of God. And this is not, dear friends, some kind of a nationalism here. This is not some kind of loyalty to a racial bloodline. This is not, well, I'm a Hebrew, so I guess I better hang out with Hebrew people. Notice that we're told that Moses makes this decision not on the basis of his national feelings, not on the basis of some kind of racial connection. We're told that he made this decision on the basis of faith. And notice the writer is very careful. He chose to be mistreated along with, not the Hebrew people. Notice specifically the writer refers to them as the people of God, the people who belong to God, the people who are in covenantal relationship with God. Now, why is this an act of faith that Moses would choose to be identified with them? Faith, don't forget, is always a response to revelation. What has been given to this group of people? Exceedingly wonderful and precious promises. Promises given to this group of people. Moses says, I want to be a part of that people with whom God has made, to whom God has made his promises. I want to be a part of that group. I want to belong to those people. You see, in the mind of Moses, beloved, this is not a step down. In the mind of Moses, this is the most exciting path he could possibly take. I want to belong to those people who are God's unique possession, the people to whom God has given incredible promises. From the perspective of the world, you see, Moses gave up everything to have nothing. But from the vantage point of faith, were you to ask Moses, Moses gave up nothing to have everything. He chose to be identified with the people of God. He wanted to be with the people of God. Can you imagine this? Friends, this is something that absolutely astounds me about Moses. Every time I read Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, I am just blown away at how deeply Moses prizes the people of God. He in every way rebukes me as a pastor. I mean, the fact of the matter is, who in his right mind would ever have wanted to lead the children of Israel? I mean, Moses had spent 40 years of his life running with Egyptian aristocracy. He was sophisticated. He was intelligent. He was educated. He was cultured. He was well-bred. He enjoyed the best of things in this life. The Hebrews, to the contrary, unpolished, unsophisticated, uneducated, blue-collar people who bore no sense of dignity whatsoever. Who in his right mind would ever want to identify with such a bunch as that group of people? You say, well, Art, well, to be sure, perhaps they were an unsophisticated crowd, but maybe it was the relational thing that meant a lot to Moses. Maybe they really were just kind of a nice bunch of folk. Group of people to hang around with. You read Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy? This group of people? Complainers. Whiners. Betrayers. Backbiters. Usurpers. Steadily criticizing Moses' leadership, steadily jealous of his authority, steadily bent on their own autonomy and stubbornness. In fact, on more than one occasion, if you can imagine it, these people actually corrupt Moses' own brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, who in turn seek to defy Moses' authority. You recall that even on one occasion, God himself wanted to do away with the whole lot of them? Remember that occasion God comes up to Moses and said, Moses, I tell you what, I've had enough of these people. They are gone. They are history. I've made up my mind. I'm going to start all over again with you. Isn't this neat, Moses? Forget Abraham. Forget Isaac and Jacob. I'm starting with you. I'm going to build a new nation beginning with you. What do you think about that, Moses? Step aside while I obliterate the people. And you know, friends, I know how I would have responded had I had it in there. May I watch you do it? There are a handful of guys that have really been a burr in my saddle. Let me see them get it at least. Is that how Moses responds? Don't forget, he's the meekest man on all the earth. If you can imagine it, beloved, Moses pleads with God to change his mind. This is how deeply he loves the people of God. As it were, he takes up the role of a priest, making intercession on their behalf. It is very much a foreshadow of the priestly work of Jesus Christ. Moses, you see, beloved, is no hired gun. Moses isn't in this business for a paycheck. Moses, to use the word of Jesus Christ in John chapter 10, is no hireling. He is everything a pastor ought to be. In fact, Moses says to God, if you're going to kill all of them, then you might as well take me out too. Beloved, why in the world does he choose knowingly this mistreatment that he would experience for 40 years? Why would he do such a thing? It's because he regards it as a small price to pay to be identified with the people who belong to God, who have been the recipients of God's wonderful covenantal promises. And what a very important thing to be writing to these Hebrew Christians. You remember back in chapter 10? The Hebrew writer has to get at those people a little bit because some of them have started to forsake the assembling of God's people together. Some of them were not prizing the assembly of God's people, getting inconsistent. Part of the reason for that, of course, is that persecution was making it difficult for them to meet. They need to hear this word. And what about people like us, beloved? Do you prize identification with the people of God more than your own personal convenience? Do you prize identification with the people of God more than your own personal schedule, more than your own free time? How would you willingly endure mistreatment if doing so could be alleviated by forsaking the meeting of God's with God's people? How important to you are the people of God, associating with them? What sacrifices are you ready to endure that you might aggressively attach yourself to the people of God? Minister among the people of God. Moses consciously endured and chose mistreatment because he prized identification with God's people. Secondly, notice, and this much more explicit, he consciously chose mistreatment because he regarded heavenly reward as more valuable than worldly wealth. He regarded heavenly reward as more valuable than worldly wealth. Verse 26, he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. I told the folk in the first service this morning, when I was a little boy, I appeared on a Bay Area television show. I don't even know if my own family knows this. I appeared on one of these local TV shows. It was called The Captain Satellite Show. Some of you remember that show? And there was a little game that took place on the course of this show, and whichever of the three or four children won the game, that child got to choose at the end of the show between a couple of prizes. And I happened to win the game on the show that day, and so Captain Satellite came up to me, and the TV thing is right on my face, and he says, "Now, Art, you get to choose whatever you want. Here's a check for $25, or here are three bags, big bags, of candy. $25, three bags of candy." Now, on the one hand, there's my mom saying, "Take the 25 bucks. Take the 25 bucks. We can buy you some PF Flyers. Take the 25 bucks. For some of you who are not old enough to know what PF Flyers are, imagine Air Jordan, and it's the same thing 30 years ago. On the other hand, here is Captain Satellite saying, "Look at all that candy. Look at all that candy." And so here is this calculation going on in my mind. The money or the candy? The money or the candy? The money or the candy? Guess what I chose? I chose the candy. I regarded it as more valuable than the $25, with which I now know I could have purchased about 15 bags of candy. It was a dumb choice. Well, you see, this is what's going on in the mind of Moses, a kind of calculation. On the one hand, there are the treasures of Egypt, treasures that he knew all too well because they had surrounded the first 40 years of his life. An infinite store of treasures. On the other hand, what's the other option? Choice two. Incessant, unending, ongoing, verbal reproaches and insults on the part of his enemies. Now, which do you choose? I mean, if you're driven by self-interest, it's a slam dunk, isn't it? There's no contest. You choose the candy, the treasures of Egypt. But in his calculations, notice, beloved, that Moses factors something into the equation that can only be seen by the eyes of faith. That's why we're told that he does this on the basis of faith. Verse 26, he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. In other words, any of the reproaches I bear here in this life by virtue of identifying with the people of God, reproaches that would be very much like the reproaches endured by Jesus Christ, reproaches that are borne for the sake of Christ's cause and for the sake of the people who belong to Jesus Christ, all of these reproaches would be well worth any earthly sacrifice because God has made a promise to me and I'm acting on the basis of that promise. That promise is this, that the best is yet to come. The promise of heaven, the promise of reward, the promise of the smile of God on the great and final day. His focus, you see, beloved, was steadily riveted upon the prize that awaited him in heaven. You've heard me tell the story on several occasions, have you not, of that great Puritan Richard Baxter? This man was the greatest, most prodigious writer in all of the English language. He personally catechized and discipled every family in the town where he lived, in Kidderminster. He was an incredibly productive pastor, a man who lived with incessant pain for the totality of his adult existence. Enormous pain without ever any relief throughout the totality of his life. And you look at a guy like Baxter and you say, "Baxter, what's your secret? How could you be so productive for the sake of the gospel in the midst of such overwhelming physical infirmities?" And as you read Baxter, you discover that there was one primary secret to his life. He said he had made a decision as a young man to think about heaven for 30 minutes every day. That That's exactly what this is saying to us. He was willing to endure it all regarding reproaches as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. And that word speaks of concentrated attention. It speaks of intensive focus that is ongoing. In other words, this just isn't an occasional thing. Every Sunday I happen to think about heaven. Every Sunday I happen to think about God. Every Sunday I happen to think about my future. This is the ongoing practice of Moses' life. Here is the key to understanding why it is that he did what he did. He was incessantly preoccupied, beloved, with his heavenly reward. I don't know how he could have endured this in any other way. But as a result of doing it, he was strengthened to endure any of the suffering and sacrifice necessary that he might accomplish God's unique purpose and call for his life. His faith was riveted on the reward that was to come. This, beloved, is a faith worthy of our emulation. How would our lives be different if we steadily made decisions on the basis of what awaited us after this life was through? To the contrary, one wonders how many of the decisions we make on a daily basis are grounded in the fact that we're living for pleasure here and now. Moses was willing to give up everything if that's what it required. It reminds me, I was thinking this past week of Shakespeare's story, The Merchant of Venice. It's a story about a wonderful young woman, a beautiful woman by the name of Portia, who was a wealthy heiress and who had many suitors of noble birth who sought her hand in marriage. Her father, wanting to make sure that a man wanted to marry her for the right reason, decrees that her husband would be selected by means of a certain test. She would belong to the man who would choose the right chest out of three which her father had prepared. One chest was made of pure gold, and on it was inscribed, "Who chooses me shall gain what many men desire." Inside of the chest was a skull. The second chest was made of silver. The inscription on it read this way, "Who chooses me shall get as much as he deserves." And inside of it was a picture of a fool. The third chest was made of lead, and on the inside of it was Portia's picture. On the outside of it read this inscription, "Who chooses me must give and hazard all that he has." Well, all of her suitors, as you can imagine, choose one of the first two chests because the allurements to them externally were so attractive. One man, however, a man by the name of Bassiano, chooses the lead chest, and in so doing acquires Portia's hand in marriage because he was willing to give up everything he had that he might have her. And this, beloved, you see, is what Moses does. He prized the reward of heaven over against all else. It's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. "Therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. This is a faith worthy of your emulation, beloved. This is a faith that is focused, preoccupied with, riveted upon the blessing of heavenly reward. And this kind of faith, I appeal to you this morning, is the kind of faith that will allow you to endure the most violent kind of sacrifices that you ever may be called to in the name of Jesus Christ during your life here. It's the kind of faith that will keep you falling away from Jesus Christ when doing so looks to be so powerfully attractive. I'm reminded of a scene that we read about in the Gospels when the disciples of Jesus, on one occasion, at a time when they were undoubtedly feeling spiritually smug and together, say to Jesus, "We've left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us? And of course, Jesus responds graciously to them. I think had it been me, I would have probably said something like this. What you gave up? Fishing boats? Fishing nets? Bait? Smelly hands? Tax tables? On the other hand, Moses renounces the world. It's one thing to give up a fishing boat. It's another thing to give up being a prince of Egypt. But you realize, beloved, of course, that all of this pales into insignificance when we consider the sacrifice made by Jesus Christ in order that he might fulfill the purposes of God for his life. Moses relinquishes the glories of this world that he might identify with and deliver the suffering and enslaved people of God. He became poor that others might become rich. When we come to the greater Moses, Jesus Christ, what do we discover? That he turned back his back on the eternal glories of heaven that were rightfully his. That he consciously lays aside his royal robes and took to himself the form of the lowliest kind of servant. He chose mistreatment. He chose disgrace. He chose the reproach of the cross itself because he was riveted on the promise of his reward, resurrection from the dead, and the salvation of a multitude of people just like us. I don't leave you this morning, beloved, with the faith of Moses. I push you to where the writer of Hebrews will push us in just a few weeks. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set forth before him endured the cross. Why did he endure the cross for us? Because of the joy that was set forth before him. Because of the promise of heavenly reward. The salvation of sinful people just like you and me. To be sure, the faith of Moses is a faith worthy of emulation. But my dear friends, I call you to an infinitely higher model. The faith of Jesus Christ, who by his faith secured the salvation of all who would place their faith in him. A faith focused on the blessing of heavenly reward. I hope that's where your faith is set this morning. It's the only way that you will make it through this life in a way that is pleasing to the living God. Would you bow your heads with me, please? Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your many and mighty blessings to us. We thank you, O God, for your wonderful word. And Father, from time to time, it is essential that every one of us so easily attracted to this world, have our attentions fixed upon that greater reward, the promise of heaven, the promise of being with you, the promise of seeing your smile and hearing your blessing upon us. Our Father, I pray that you would give to us this kind of faith. We realize that it's not your plan for everyone to make the kinds of sacrifices that Moses made. You had a distinct call for him that was different than the call you had on the life of Moses. We also realize, dear Lord, that there are times when our allegiance to Jesus Christ calls for great sacrifice, great mistreatment, at times great suffering. And I pray, O Lord and God, that when confronted with such choices, that we would be faithful to you first and foremost, by virtue of the fact that we would be looking ahead to our reward, the fulfillment of the promises that you have made to us. Our Father, we love you this morning. We count it a privilege to endure any kind of sacrifice in this life for the sake of Jesus Christ. Help us to prize your people. Help us to love your people. Help us to be willing to make any kind of personal sacrifices necessary that we might identify with your people and be with your people and love them and even suffer with them. Fix our gaze, O Lord, on the reality of heaven and all of its blessings. We thank you this morning, not just for Moses, but even more importantly, eternally more importantly, we thank you for Jesus Christ, who made the greatest sacrifice in light of what would prove to be the greatest reward. We love you and thank you for your mercy to us in Jesus' name.